From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this week's podcast, we take a look at the massive mortgage settlements being paid by banks that played a role in the 2008 financial crisis. Who is that money really helping?
Keeping people in their homes was the most important and the predominant need or the predominant goal of the settlement, but it wasn't the only one.
Then the manufacturer of an all-new electric bus fleet raises safety concerns.
They call this the cutting edge or the bleeding edge. And we want to be cutting, we don't want to be bleeding. So we're going to evaluate these vehicles very carefully.
And we get an inside perspective on the life of a hitman, a fake hitman.
He's kind of playing like a little bit of a Superman role. He has his disguise in his trunk and he gets changed into his hitman gear and he goes out and pretends to be a hitman.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. This week, JPMorgan Chase agreed to a $13 billion settlement with the Justice Department over the sale of faulty mortgage securities that led to the financial crisis. It's the largest settlement with a single company in U.S. history. $4 billion from that settlement must go to help the millions of families who saw the values of their homes plummet and who still struggle to keep up with mortgage payments. But this is not the first multi-billion dollar mortgage settlement. In 2012, the federal government reached a $25 billion agreement with five major banks. A portion of that money was also supposed to help homeowners. But has that money actually helped those underwater on their homes or still facing foreclosure? That's our cover story today. Joseph Smith oversees that 2012 mortgage settlement as the federally appointed monitor. His job is to make sure banks meet the terms of the agreement. And he's going to do the same for the new agreement with JPMorgan Chase. And so I asked him, how much of the tens of billions of dollars already spent by banks has directly helped homeowners?
The majority, in fact, more than a majority of the relief will be the kind of relief that we all agree will keep people in their homes.
With the assistance that's been received, do we have a sense of how many homeowners have been helped to stay where they are, to stay in their homes?
Overall, the banks have claimed, and I haven't completed my crediting on this yet, and it includes short sales and other, it's over 600,000 families. I think the number, if you include refinancing and principal forgiveness, it will be less than that number. But it's a significant number of people.
Under the settlement, the banks, they can sell foreclosed on homes at a loss or take homes in exchange for debt forgiveness. In both those cases, the homeowner's debt is forgiven, but they still lose their home. To what extent have the banks pursued these options?
Well, if you're talking about either short sales or deeds in lieu of foreclosure, and that's what you are talking about, where people essentially give up their homes, that has been a significant number of the loans which have been the subject of relief under the settlement. I do think it is only fair to say that there are times when a short sale or a deed in lieu is the least worst option for a distressed borrower. If, for example, you or I have lost a job and need to move to another place to get a new job, and we're stuck with a house that's underwater, the least worst option for you or me might well be to do a short sale, get out from under the loan, have the house sold, and reboot, go back and start your life again. Hmm. Keeping people in their homes was the most important and the predominant need or the predominant goal of the settlement, but it wasn't the only one.
Joe, you've just been handed a big pile of new work. You've been appointed to monitor this new settlement this week, the $13 billion agreement between JPMorgan Chase and the federal government. So what are you going to be looking for from the bank just right off the bat over the next 6 months?
Well, there has not been an official announcement, but if there is one, I would be honored to do the work you're talking about. And I will say here is an example of where the settlements we've had learn from each other. Some of the criticisms that were made of the National Mortgage Settlement, of which I'm currently monitor, have been reflected when people listened. We will continue to have, as I understand it, relief directed towards keeping people in the homes, as we discussed, principal forgiveness in particular. But there's also going to be an explicit requirement to extend what's called blight relief, which is put people in new housing or fixed-up housing, will address the needs of a lot of our urban areas in particular. So I'm very happy about that.
Joe, do you feel at this point that these settlements, that they're making any progress in terms of righting the wrongs of the excesses of that led to the collapse?
Well, the JPMorgan Chase U.S. Justice Settlement addresses, as I understand it, origination issues in the mortgage market. So I think that is clearly a step forward in that regard. The settlement I'm working on now addresses some of the aftermath of the meltdown, which was how distressed borrowers were treated by people who were trying to collect money from them. And I think we've made real progress there. And so the short answer to your question, I guess, is yes. I mean, I think the trend of these settlements has been to address the problems that not only caused the meltdown and that resulted from it. So I'm pretty happy about that.
Joseph Smith, he'll be monitoring the J.P. Morgan settlement. Eric Schneiderman is the Attorney General of New York. He's also a co-chair of the President's Residential Mortgage-Backed Securities Working Group. That's the group tasked with righting the wrongs of the foreclosure crisis. Schneiderman was an architect of both the 2012 National Mortgage Settlement and this week's J.P. Morgan Chase settlement. He sees it as a victory.
This is a huge win, and I think we're going to be able to, with this settlement and others to follow, really boost the housing market in our state and get a lot of people out from underwater and see housing prices started to go up again, which is good for everybody.
But he says this week's settlement is just the beginning.
There are a lot of other lawsuits that have already been filed, and you will see more complaints filed in the months ahead. But the banks want to settle existing cases, and they want to eliminate the possibility that investigations that are now underway that haven't led to lawsuits can be discontinued. So there's a tremendous incentive for the banks to do what Chase has done. I think we've gotten this off to a start, and I don't think anyone can say that the federal working group that the president set up doesn't pack a big punch.
Bruce Marks is the CEO of the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, a national housing advocacy group.
When you hear these big numbers in these settlements, it's really not real for the most part because the banks are doing this in their normal course of business.
You know, we've had people telling us, including the New York State Attorney General, that these settlements, they're working. They're doing a good job to fix this problem.
Well, you know, they really need to go get on the ground. They need to, because it's really not working out there. You're not seeing the kind of principal reductions and reaffordable payments that need to happen. And there's an easy way to do it. What they need to do is they got to say, banks, you need to do what you should be doing in your normal course of business. And then when a homeowner is denied a modification, then use the money to turn a negative into a positive. And they're not doing that, and they're letting the banks play with the money to move it from one place to another without really the benefits going to the homeowner.
Bruce, how should this money be spent? What would be the right way to go about this?
It should be restitution for the homeowners, and it should be restitution for the communities that have been impacted. And that's not what's happening. But the positive thing about the agreement, which I think needs to be reinforced, is that the only way you're going to send a message to these banks in the future is if you do the criminal prosecution.
Mark says the government needs to prosecute those who sold the fraudulent mortgages in the first place.
And this agreement is really interesting, where you've got Chase cooperating and to really prosecute the Bear Stearns executives, the Washington Mutual executives. So I think there's a lot of good stuff in here, but the problem is they've also got to really enforce it that this is restitution that has to happen. And then they have to make this money real that says we're only going to use this, you know, $13 billion when it can really provide a real benefit for the homeowners.
And while J.P. Morgan Chase did not admit any wrongdoing as part of the latest settlement, the agreement does leave the door open to future criminal prosecutions of bank executives. As the country still grapples with the effects of the 2008 crisis, Congress is working on preventing the next one. New licensing rules limit who can give mortgages, and lawmakers are considering ways to change how the mortgage market is funded. If you've been following the news, you've likely heard of the recent First Step deal between Iran, the U.S., and five other world powers to curb Iran's nuclear program. One of the key players in that deal is Secretary of State John Kerry. The former senator and presidential candidate is a familiar face in American foreign policy. Journalist David Rode has a profile of Kerry in the latest issue of The Atlantic. Rode says one of the most defining aspects of Kerry's work now is that he's willing to take risks, especially in one of the most diplomatically difficult parts of the world, the Middle East. And that risk-taking has a lot to do with the fact that Kerry no longer has an eye on higher office.
That's what's so unusual about Kerry. You know, Secretary Clinton worked extremely hard, but she was seen as being very cautious about hanging her legacy on the Middle East. Kerry has taken the opposite approach. He has embraced the Middle East. He's spent the vast majority of his time there, and he's really engaging in very, very risky diplomatic efforts that might fail. And speaking with him, he talked about how he's changed, he's learned from failures in life. And then his aides told me that as he's sort of let go of his dream of becoming president after his loss in 2004 to George W. Bush, Kerry is willing to take risks because he's no longer dreaming of becoming president. He's got something very rare in Washington, you know, where there's a lot of caution and calculation. He really has nothing to lose.
There's been that critique that it's a bit haphazard, like the incident mentioning the possibility of an opening in the chemical weapons negotiations with Syria.
One of the defining traits of Kerry's tenure as Secretary of State has been his gaffes, and the most famous one was in the buildup to potential American airstrikes in Syria. Kerry, at this press conference in London, was asked hypothetically what could the Syrian government do that might allow them to avert these airstrikes. And Kerry, seemingly on the fly, said, well, they could turn over all of their chemical weapons to the international community and agree to have them destroyed. And he told me later it was a purposeful comment that there were behind-the-scenes talks about this kind of proposal, but no one thought that the Russians or Syrians were really serious about acting on it. After that offhand comment, the Russian officials and Syrian officials suddenly said they would accept that deal, and it created an opening for President Obama to not carry out what were becoming very unpopular airstrikes. In other situations, his gaffes have created real problems. In one interview in Pakistan, he said the U.S. had a timeline for ending drone strikes. That's completely against administration policy. And then he also praised the Egyptian army in this same interview in Pakistan. And then on a later visit to Egypt, he praised the army again, saying it was restoring democracy in Egypt. And you immediately had officials in Washington trying to walk back his statements.
You read about a moment that could have played out differently that was earlier this spring when Secretary Kerry was supposed to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but it did not go as planned. Can you talk about what happened?
It was Kerry's first visit to Moscow as Secretary of State. I was one of the pool reporters that were traveling with him, and we arrived at the Kremlin, and he was supposed to meet with President Putin. And it was very strange because Kerry didn't go in the Kremlin when we all expected he would. Instead, he starts walking around Red Square, sort of pointing at different buildings and asking questions about Russian architecture. And we were all sort of confused about what was happening. Kerry ended up going inside the Kremlin at that point and waiting and waiting. He eventually went back to his hotel. And what had happened was that Vladimir Putin kept John Kerry waiting for 3 hours for their face-to-face meeting. And in what his aides call classic Kerry, if there's some kind of diplomatic goal, John Kerry will do whatever it takes. And critics say this can lead to bad deals and is a dangerous thing. But in that case, he had hours of meetings with the Russians. He praised Vladimir Putin at a late-night press conference for giving him such a warm welcome. And it didn't bother him at all.
Do you think Hillary Clinton would have put up with that?
Well, there's some people that said that other secretaries of states would have gotten on their plane and left. You know, and again, Kerry's a mixed bag. I think there is a lot of arrogance and ambition there. But he said that there's a war going on in Syria. Thousands of people are dying. And if, you know, I end up sitting around and waiting for a few hours and it can somehow lead to a potential resolution of the war in Syria, I'm willing to do that.
That's David Rode. His profile of John Kerry appears in the latest issue of The Atlantic magazine. He joined us from our New York bureau. David, thank you again.
Thank you.
You can find Johnnie Walker whiskey in pretty much every country in the world, even places where alcohol is banned. 120 million of those iconic square bottles with a little walking man on them were sold worldwide last year. And it's no accident that the blended Scotch whiskey is rising in popularity, especially in places with a booming middle class, from South America to Africa. Afshin Malavi is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. He recently wrote about Johnnie Walker's global domination in Foreign Policy magazine. He joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Afshin.
Hi there. Nice to be with you.
So I want to start with a bit of tape. This is from a commercial for Johnnie Walker. This is from Mexico. Since this is radio, we know, understand it's dramatic, but you better describe what's going on.
It's a great ad. You have a group of Mexicans, many of them looking quite middle class, walking up a hill, but they are bound by a chain. And as they walk up and up and up, this chain is attached to a boulder. And at some point, the chains snap, Everyone falls to the ground, black birds circle above, and suddenly, one by one, they begin to unburden themselves from the ropes and the chains, and they walk up, 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 up the mountain, and suddenly you cue the soaring and inspiring music and the blue sky vistas. At the very end of this advertisement, you see the tagline, "Keep walking Mexico," with that iconic Johnny Walker brand.
You think that Johnny Walker is trying to do something more with this ad, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in many ways, Johnny Walker has set itself up as this kind of global aspirational drink of the middle class. They have an ad in Greece, and in the ad it says something like, "Keep walking even though there's rain, even though there's a storm, and keep walking with hope in your hearts." And so they're really kind of playing on, you know, nationalism, national aspiration, national achievement, and they seem to be doing a pretty good job.
I've been preaching about the transformative power of whiskey for a long time, and nobody's listened to me.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, but what's interesting is where they're growing. They're really growing in the emerging markets. We're looking at another 3 billion people entering the global middle class by the year 2030. So what are companies like Johnny Walker's parent company, Diageo, doing? They're chasing that global middle class, as is McDonald's, as is Starbucks. And the way Diageo and Johnny Walker are doing it is they're targeting what I call the glams, the global aspirational middle classes, the ones who are rising, and they're urging them to keep walking, and they're urging them as they walk, oh, by the way, as they say in Scotland, take a wee dram of whiskey along the way.
Is there a reason why whiskey is a better measure of this kind of growth than other things, say, like, you know, caviar or Humvees?
You know, it's a good question. I think whiskey's maybe a little bit more accessible, particularly the Red Label, which is kind of the entry-level brand. Johnny Walker has become something like Rolex and Louis Vuitton in the sense that even if you can't afford it, there are actual Johnny Walker fakes that you can purchase in stores and put them on your mantelpiece. You may not want to drink it, but you want to show your guests that, yes, you too can afford Johnny Walker Scotch whiskey. But what's interesting about this story is this was a company founded in 1819 as a small general grocer in Scotland. And then around the early 20th century, the sons of the original founder, John Walker, really began effectively marketing this brand. And over lunch, writing on the back of a napkin, an advertiser by the name of Tom Brown created the Striding Man icon. And when you look at today's Striding Man is just a silhouette. So in a sense, he could be anyone. He could be you. He could be someone in Africa, someone in India, someone in China. And so they've done a pretty good job of kind of making the Striding Man an everyman.
Afshin Mulavi, his article on Johnny Walker appears in Foreign Policy magazine, and it's called Straight Up. Afshin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, let me take you to a shady parking lot in Colorado. Two men are meeting.
They're in the parking lot of a Loaf and Jug, which is kind of like a convenience store.
That's our guide for this story.
Jean Marie Laskis. I'm a correspondent at GQ magazine.
One of the men is named Lucero. He's meeting another guy who's sitting in his parked truck. Here's how Laskis describes that guy.
He's got a lot of tattoos, mean, angry tattoos all over him, and lots of big, silver, mean-looking rings, long, skinny beard hanging down his chest. He looks just like what you want a hitman to look like.
He's a hitman, and that's where this story gets a little graphic.
You still want to do it?
Oh, yeah, I do.
You want it done soon?
That's a recording from the meeting between Lucero and the hitman.
Lucero is kind of nervous because he's never dealt with a hitman before. And he is excited because this hitman is going to solve his problems. He's going to make right in his mind the wrong that was done to him by his girlfriend.
Lucero says that when his girlfriend broke up with him, she laughed at him. He wants the hitman to attack her, specifically to slash her face, leave her with a permanent disfigured smile, like the Joker. Revenge for that laugh.
I'm talking about, I want her life a completely living hell to where what she did to me. I want it to be a vice versa. What she took from me is what I'm going to take back.
Lucero's short on cash. So the payment will be guns, a shotgun and an AK-47 assault rifle. But the hitman gives Lucero a chance to back out.
So you know when you leave here today...
A deal's a deal.
Deal's a deal. It's a done deal. Because I'm on it now.
Lucero is undeterred. The deal is finalized, and Lucero gets ready to step out of the truck.
All right.
But all right, man. So right. Once I leave this door, it's on, and you got your deal? All
right. So I got to go?
Got to go.
All right.
All right, brother.
All right.
Be careful now.
I'll try.
When Lucero finally leaves the car, what we come to realize is this hitman is an undercover ATF agent who has only been posing as a hitman all this time.
That's why we have those tapes. They were recorded by the hitman, a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. The ATF says John Lucero received an 11-year prison sentence for the attempted hit. But then there's the other character in this story, the person Jean-Marie Laskus calls the hitman, who's not really a hitman. He's one of many special agents who do this undercover work, stopping murders for hire. Laskus spent several days meeting with this particular agent. She calls him Charles Hunt, but that's a pseudonym, because this agent spends most of his time living another life.
Every day, pretty much, he's changing into his, you know, dirtbag gear. He said he's putting on his jewelry. But he works the streets, finding out who out there needs what. But the word gets out that he'll do anything for a price. Anything. This is a word-of-mouth kind of job.
And how would you describe him beyond the sort of hitman caricature that he portrays?
Well, he's just a lovely, lovely man. Sort of soft-spoken, kind-hearted, family guy, couple kids, lovely wife. He's kind of playing like a little bit of a Superman role. He has his disguise in his trunk, and he gets changed into his hitman gear, and he goes out and pretends to be a hitman.
You got to think, doesn't it take a toll on somebody that decent to be portraying someone so indecent all the time?
Well, and I think in his case, for a time it did. You know, he's been through, you know, many of these experiences with horrible things, people wanting fingertips, people wanting eyeballs. I mean, just really gruesome things. And at one point, he was undercover for months at a some Aryan Nation kind of biker home. And he did not come out of that hole. He came out of that having a hard time remembering who he was. And in fact, his marriage did not last through that whole period of his life. So I think it does take quite a toll on these people.
Jean-Marie Laskus says it's hard to say just how often contract murders are committed. After all, thousands of murders go unsolved every year. But her meetings with this agent revealed how the world of underground crime sometimes does business in places as banal as a Loaf and Jug parking lot.
I guess I didn't realize that. You know, we kind of live in our sanitized lives. We're not involved. We don't get exposed to violent crime in our daily lives. But maybe it's right underneath our noses and we don't realize it. And there's this army of agents out there kind of keeping things at bay.
That's Jean-Marie Laskus. Her article appears in the latest issue of GQ. It's called Oops, You Just Hired the Wrong Hitman. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. There's no income tax in Nevada. Come to Las Vegas and you'll see why. They don't need one. More than 30 million tourists a year stumble down the Las Vegas Strip, and those tourists mostly come to gamble, leaving behind a ridiculous amount of money. And for decades, business boomed. But the financial collapse hit Las Vegas hard. Despite what people have been saying for years, the gaming industry is not recession-proof. According to UNLV's Center for Gaming Research, casino revenues on the Las Vegas Strip dropped for 22 straight months during the last recession, and the city became the unofficial foreclosure capital of the U.S. But Las Vegas is clawing its way back, and in doing so, may emerge as more than a one-economy town. That's our cover story today, The Push to Diversify Sin City. Let's be clear. Gambling is not going anywhere. It's still what drives the city. But 2008 was a wake-up call. Rick Lax is a writer who lives and breathes Las Vegas, It was a shock for him to see his city linked with another perennial struggler.
Detroit, and right after that is Las Vegas. That's what you would always hear for years and years. We were just ahead of Detroit. It hit us hard.
Well, I remember some people were thinking that Las Vegas would maybe be immune somehow, and it seemed for the first 6 months, like it got there, but there was a little bit of a delay.
There was, which I remember that hope. But then it turns out when people don't have money, in fact, they do not have money to come out to Las Vegas and gamble. And it really sunk in once President Obama made that comment, you know, he used as an example of fiscal irresponsibility coming to Vegas on a bender. And that's when we knew we were in bad shape.
Now, Las Vegas is a place that's remade itself before. I mean, I remember during the 90s that it got a lot more family friendly. But one more recent trend that I've seen coming into town recently, there's been a change in the billboards. There used to be a lot more about the penny slots and the best buffets, and now there are a lot of dance clubs, it seems.
Yeah, and these billboards, my parents come visit me. They have no idea what these billboards are. It'll just be a blank billboard with the name, you know, Cascade or Tiesto. These are, you know, electronic dance musicians. They're DJs, and they are huge now. The club scene has boomed in the past 5 years. We have just been opening up mega club after mega club, and now if you look at, you know, the list of the highest money-making clubs in the United States, if you look at that top 10 list, 7 of them are right here in Las Vegas. Why are you my
clarity? We visited one of the newest clubs. It's called Light. It opened in May at the Mandalay Bay Casino and Hotel. It cost more than $25 million, and you can tell. Massive walls of LED screens illuminate the room. Lasers, strobes, fog cannons. And if that weren't spectacle enough, Light is a partnership with Cirque du Soleil.
And in the ceiling above us is tracks where the Cirque performers kind of swing from the rafters and do their usual performances. So all this is happening while the club's going on.
So it looks like between the tracks and those catwalks, they can pretty much get from
one side to the other.
Sort of like going to a Las Vegas show, but you actually get to sit in the show.
You're part of the experience.
That's Andy Massey. He's the CEO of the Light Group. The vast interior of the club was empty and quiet while we were there. No acrobats dangling above us right now. But it still screamed opulence. Partygoers pay from $30 to get into the door to $10,000 to get a prime table.
It's part of the culture right now. You know, it's the 60s had rock, and, you know, there's different sorts of movements. This is a movement, and these DJs who are creating this music.
It's not like the old idea of a DJ. They're not up there spinning discs or even doing like a little bit of scratch. They're
producers.
Composers,
they're composers. Right? They're creating music. And it's really something that has inspired, you know, a massive generation.
Obviously, these dance clubs are, they're just getting bigger and bigger and making huge amounts of money, and it's not gambling.
You know, I think the market has shifted a bit where, you know, Gen X and, you know, and Gen Y are really more into entertainment and dining and seeing shows and staying in great hotels than they are into gaming. Gaming is still a big part of Las Vegas, right? But I think people are coming because the experience you get in Vegas.
Well, it's the thing, man. Nowadays, I don't think, when I think of Mandalay Bay, you know, I don't think of gambling. I think about the Shark Reef, taking kids there, or the restaurants here, and now, you know, this massive, crazy nightclub.
Well, it's the mixture of it all. I don't think you could have one without the other. The gambling helps the hotels, and the clubs help the gambling, and it's just all part of the entertainment. And I think that's what makes Vegas really unique.
Andy Massey, he's the man behind one of the newest nightclubs in Las Vegas, Light. A couple of miles away, one very unusual CEO is trying to bring the spirit of a party to a corporation. The headquarters of Zappos is in downtown Las Vegas, the real Vegas, one might say. The Strip is actually outside city limits. Zappos, you probably know, transformed how people buy shoes. Now its founder, Tony Hsieh, wants to transform Las Vegas. In 2009, Hsieh sold the company to Amazon for $1.2 billion. And with some of that money, he started the Downtown Project. In one way, it's a venture capital firm trying to attract new industries. But in other ways, it's much more ambitious. Tony Hsieh wants to rethink city planning, imagining how a well-designed city can breed innovation. The secret is forcing more collaborations, something he likes to call collisions.
We actually at Zappos prioritize collisions over convenience.
One example, Zappos' new headquarters in downtown Vegas, in what used to be City Hall.
There's a parking garage outside where the city employees used to park. But the city employees used to park there, walk across the sky bridge that connects directly into the building. Well, we actually shut down that sky bridge, which forces employees out into the street, resulting in more collisions with the community and with each other. And then they walk around into the central plaza, which becomes another collision space.
So what are you getting, or what do you hope to get from having collisions with your staff and the community of Las Vegas?
Yes, so the research has shown that most innovation actually comes from something outside your industry or outside of your area of expertise being combined with your own. And so on the city level, it's really important for people from all different backgrounds and industries to collide and talk to each other. That's where a lot of the great ideas come from.
Tony Shea has already forced a few collisions. He's funded companies like CrowdHall, a site that hosts Q&A sessions where visitors vote on the best questions, and Fluencer, a site that rethinks celebrity endorsement and gets companies to offer everyday people endorsements instead.
The Downtown Project is a separate company from Zappos, and it has a $350 million budget that's roughly divided into $50 million to be invested into small businesses to help build a sense of neighborhood and community. $50 million into tech companies. In the past year, we've relocated about 60 companies from other states or even countries, actually, to downtown Vegas. $50 million into education, arts, music, and so on. And then $200 million into real estate to really make it a connected city, one where you can walk from block to block to block. And there's a few different goals. One is to have everything you need to live, work, play within walking distance. Another is to make downtown Vegas the most community-focused large city in the world and probably the place most people would least expect it. Mm-hmm. And a third is to make it the co-working and co-learning capital of the world. And for those who may not be familiar with the concept of co-working, it's this thing that started out in San Francisco, I think, almost a decade ago, where a bunch of small tech startups worked in the same physical space side by side, even though they were different companies. But what they found was they would start overhearing each other's conversations, and that would result in these serendipitous interactions, and they'd start collaborating, and it actually drove a lot of innovation and productivity.
Tony Shea, founder of Zappos and the Downtown Project, a $350 million investment in the Fremont East section of Las Vegas. For other new sources of revenue, Las Vegas is looking to the skies. Next month, the FAA will decide on a new test site for unmanned aerial vehicles, better known as drones. Nevada is vying for that honor.
We are the birthplace of the industry.
Tom Wilsek fronts the effort for the governor's office, and he cites the Department of Defense research done here in the early 1990s.
We also have the largest concentration of unmanned aerial vehicle pilots in the world.
Military pilots fly drones from Nellis Air Force Base right in Las Vegas. But we're not talking about more military research. The FAA is pursuing the drone's commercial possibilities.
The very first applications we're going to see are going to be agricultural and in law enforcement, more of a public safety context. Somewhere in the future, you may have packages coming from UPS or FedEx transited on aircraft that are remotely piloted.
That's new industry, and that could mean billions.
Almost a $90 billion annual revenue globally by 2025.
And Tom Wilsek hopes that nine of that $90 billion will come Nevada's way.
It's going to be enormous for our economy. The governor's made this one of his top economic development platforms.
Now, while Las Vegas appears to be branching out from its tried-and-true model, writer Rick Lax wants you to know that in Las Vegas, the casino is still king. Those big-earning dance clubs, all owned by casinos, along with plenty of other non-gambling attractions, the shows, amusement parks, mini aquariums, and zoos. As Las Vegas comes roaring back, Rick Lax says the casino will be on top.
I didn't think there were going to be any more big casinos opening up, not for another decade. But we've got this giant Chinese-themed Resorts World casino that's going to be opening up soon. So I think come 3 or 4 years, that's going to be the place to be. And people will be saying at that point, wow, Vegas really turned itself around.
One Chinese company dominates the world of electric buses. Now that manufacturer has its sights set on the U.S. with a new plant in California, a first for a Chinese auto company. NPR's Daniel Hajek reports.
Past the showroom and into the garage of BYD's North American headquarters in downtown Los Angeles sits a brand new 40-foot electric K9 bus sent direct from Shenzhen, China.
I can turn it on if you want, you know.
BYD fleet sales manager James Holtz sits in the driver's seat and pushes the power button on the dashboard.
It's on. We're ready to rock and roll.
Unlike a grumbling diesel engine, this electric bus is quiet. Holtz opens the back hatch to reveal its electric components.
Because it's non-internal combustion, you don't have the moving parts you have. You don't have the belts, you don't have the soot, you don't have all the oils and everything else.
This bus can run up to 155 miles on a single charge.
And it takes about 5 hours to fully charge our bus from zero state of charge to 100%.
BYD already has buses running at Denver International Airport and Disney World in Orlando. Just last month, Los Angeles Metro purchased 5 buses, and nearby Long Beach Transit bought 10.
It offers opportunities to implement and evaluate a new technology.
Richard Hunt manages Metro's transit capital programs.
They call this the cutting edge or the bleeding edge, and we want to be cutting, we don't want to be bleeding. So we're going to evaluate these vehicles very carefully.
Those buses LA bought will be manufactured up the road in Lancaster next year. Michael Austin, vice president of BYD America, says it's a huge step for China's auto industry.
We are the first Chinese vehicle company to come to the U.S. and build a manufacturing plant.
And they had help. The company received $2 million in tax subsidies to build its North American headquarters in L.A. But the California Labor Commissioner's office has now hit BYD with a $99,000 fine. The plant up in Lancaster, which has yet to open, is under investigation for paying workers below minimum wage. Austin argues BYD has always complied with California labor laws.
As the Chinese say, the tall trees get the most wind. Whether it's naysayers that say the technology's not mature or the battery technology's not ready, there's nothing that we can't overcome.
BYD, which stands for Build Your Dreams, started as a battery manufacturer for cell phones, then branched out to solar panels, LED lights, and electric cars.
It's a fascinating company because it's incredibly diverse.
That's Alan Onsman, an auto reporter at Bloomberg News.
It's almost like a small-scale GE or some sort of large, you know, a traditional conglomerate. It's in a lot of fields, but batteries are the core of what it does.
Onsman says it was once the fastest-growing automaker in China. Even Warren Buffett bought a 10% stake in the company.
Their auto business has dropped off a bit, and the excitement is not what it once was, but they were a rapid rising company in the Chinese market in the late 2000s.
Company founder Wang Chanfu is calling the K9 bus fleet BYD's second takeoff. Onsman says electric transportation could boost its falling profits from recent years.
This is a new emerging segment, and they want to own it.
BYD is already considered the world's largest manufacturer of electric buses, which go for about $800,000. That's over double the cost of a traditional diesel bus. But long-term savings on fuel and maintenance could go a long way. At least that's what BYD is hoping to prove in the coming months with trial runs across the U.S. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
That's the music of Krzysztof Penderecki, who turns 80 today. You may think that you'd never heard this Polish composer's music, but I'm guessing you have. Because I'm guessing you've seen The Shining. A lot of you out there are having a hard time right now not picturing Jack Nicholson brandishing an axe. Kubrick's movie terrified me as a kid. I assumed the scary music had been composed specifically for the film. As a teenager, I was shocked to learn that this was Polish religious music. It was pretty far out from what I understood church music to be. This is not an issue of radically different musical cultures. I'm pretty sure this music sounds spooky to a Polish audience. Even as this music terrifies, it draws you in. Why? Because Penderecki, like every modern European composer, worked in the shadow of the Second World War and the Holocaust. Around 60 million human beings died in World War II. About 3/4 of those were non-combatants. This is no doubt why so much modern classical music, from Europeans especially, is so difficult to listen to for a lot of people. How on earth can you write pretty music after you see what humans do at their worst? Baroque and classical composers wrote music that imitated thunder or birdsong. You can pick out different species of birds in Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony if you listen carefully. There's a cuckoo and a nightingale. Post-World War II composers like Benjamin Britten or Penderecki are more likely to imitate the sound of air raid sirens. Penderecki is not Jewish. He's not a survivor, but he is Polish. Auschwitz is basically in his backyard. Penderecki, a devout Christian writing authentically liturgical music, seems to be wrestling directly with the question of how you can make peace with God after such horrors. Maybe this is why you're more likely to hear Penderecki or Gheorghe Ligeti or George Crumb in horror movies than in concert halls, where you're more likely to hear the comforting strains of Haydn and Mozart. But the truth is, hearing this music in horror movies actually makes it less scary. Maybe to do justice to this kind of music, we need to peel it away from the movies and pay respect to the real horrors real humans have had to endure. For the week ending November 24th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Delagula, Mercia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.